From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Summertime, and the propagation is easy.
Some is easier than others. Bands have been pretty quiet lately.
Yes. Although 6 meters has had some spectacular openings.
As it often does.
Yeah, well, just this past week, the end of May, but the last few weeks, often due, and I think entirely due in this case, to the mystery of sporadic E.
Indeed.
Why is it sporadic?
It's called sporadic E because it's sporadic.
It's sporadic.
And that's what's kind of interesting about it is you can't really count on it in the same way you can on sort of our usual F-layer long-haul HF propagation, which is relatively predictable.
Mm-hmm.
You can, you know, weeks ahead, you can plan what band you're going to use and what might work. And it doesn't always work the way the plan comes out. But sporadic E is much less predictable. And that's why it's called sporadic. And it's not there very often. It's probably, especially in low sunspot cycle times as we're in now, it's probably the most popular long distance mode on 6 and 10 meters, mainly because it's one of the few that's working.
When it does work, it works spectacularly.
That's absolutely true. We should point out, it's not just 6 meters.
That's right.
In times of high sunspot activity, which we aren't in now, the 6 meters acts like a lot like 10 meters and the lower frequency bands in that you get worldwide long-haul propagation through F-layer, and the maximum usable frequency sometimes gets up into 6 meters. And that's very dramatic, too. But right now, that's not happening. But on the other hand, the sporadic E that helps 6 meters in times like this also helps 10 meters and perhaps 12. So it covers all of those bands, and they act very similarly in some respects. Those who are trying out HF on 10 meters can find often that if sporadic E is working on 6, it'll also be working on 10.
What occurs to me is that sporadic E has a tendency to favor the high power guy and the low power guy. Isn't that true?
Sporadic E doesn't take, it's one of the things about 6 meters. There are a lot of ways to propagate signals on 6 meters, but many of them, such as meteor trails and moon bounce and so forth, require big antennas and a lot of power. Sporadic E does not. Sporadic E provides a very low attenuation path in the places that it provides a path to, mm-hmm. which is not everywhere.
That's
and
right.
And it's not only sporadic in terms of only showing up at some times, it shows up in a fairly localized region, which is what makes it very fascinating. So if you're on, you particularly find this in a contest, like one of the ARL VHF contests. We have one coming up June.
I don't remember the date.
Yes, sometime in June. Check your contest.
Sometime in June, yes.
Yeah, well, shortly after this broadcast comes out, you should be getting ready for it, because one of the things about a contest on a band that doesn't get a lot of activity is when the contest is happening, there are people all over the country and perhaps all over the world on the air participating in the contest. So you find out where the propagation is going. Like the 10-meter contest in December, it's amazing how many stations you can work. And a lot of people the weekend before will be on there. They'll listen. There's nobody there. They don't bother to try it because everybody's listening and nobody's hearing anything and nobody's talking.
Yes.
But when you're in a contest, you have people talking. And what you find is the sporadic E, it's a little ionized cloud, fairly low, and it will provide a low attenuation path to someplace from the northeast where we are to the Midwest is a very typical kind of thing, or to the southwest. But during the course of the contest, it'll shift. So you'll start out talking to people in Chicago, and before you know it, you're talking to people in Arizona or South Florida, or I've worked people on the West Coast in Mexico, that kind of thing, with multiple hop, I think. And you can do this with a small station, a 10-watt, 20-watt station with a dipole antenna. You won't work all the people that you might with a big station and a big antenna, but you can work people. When the band is open, it is very open. Same thing is true with 10.
In fact, Joel, during a 6-meter sporadic E opening with 25 watts to a dipole in an attic, okay, I worked a double hop from here in Connecticut, worked a guy in Washington near Seattle.
Yeah,
on 6 meters.
That's not unusual, and it's almost as good as when the muff gets up there and you work them on F-layer, as I used to.
Yes.
I remember in the 50s, I had a SX-43 that covered 6 meters, and I went months and never heard any signals on it. It was not the greatest 6 meter receiver, and one day booming in S-9 is somebody from Washington State on 6 meters into my 40 meter dipole, and just amazing how good the band is when it's good. And 10 meters is the same way. The difference between the F layer and the sporadic E propagation is the height of the layer. It makes a big difference in terms of where you talk to. So you notice we've been talking about relatively short hops, and that's because the E layer is lower than the F layer. The E layer is typically from 60 to 75 miles high, and that means a single hop propagation, depending on the angle you approach it from, could be from typically 450 to 1,300 miles a hop. So it takes a couple hops to get across the country. Unlike F layer, which is up at in the hundreds of miles, 90 to 450 miles, it's very common to have a single hop of a couple thousand miles. So when F layer is up, it works better than E layer, but right now E layer is the one we got. And another thing that you can do, instead of waiting for a contest, is watch for beacons in particular areas. There are many beacons on 6 meters and on 10 as well. If you have a receiver that has a squelch on it, so that you don't have to be bothered by the background noise while you're working in the basement or doing your taxes or whatever, you can have that tuned to a beacon frequency at some potential skip location in the Midwest for us or something, and you'll hear it come on. And if it does, that means the band's open and you can stop doing your taxes and start playing radio. You know, if enough other people do that, so there are people there that hear beacons from your area,
yes,
you can communicate. So the important thing is to know when the band is open. Some people do another thing. They oftentimes, when 6 meters is open for sporadic E, the FM, commercial FM band is also open for sporadic E.
Oh, yes, right.
So particularly at the low end, if there's a station, a powerful station in the Midwest on a frequency that's not in use in your area, you can tune an FM radio to that station, and all of a sudden they'll pop up. And when they do, that means the band's open. Probably 6 meters is also open to the same area.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, well, I think it's fairly commonly done. Of course, the problem is there are lots of areas, and you can only probably listen to one or two stations at a time, although you could find a frequency, perhaps, that has big stations in a couple of areas. I'm not sure how well this would work. I've never tried it, but if you look at one of these station listings for 87.9 megahertz and see, that's actually probably not a good frequency because that's in the educational band. They tend to be low power. But get up into the commercial region of the FM band, and perhaps there's a frequency that has stations in multiple areas. Somebody then also has no station in your area. That's the other problem. And then when that station comes on, when any of the stations come on, they'll identify themselves, and you can know where the opening is.
Another alternative are the Whisper digital beacons.
Absolutely.
You can go to the Whisper website and look and see who is hearing who, basically, or just monitor that frequency with the Whisper software and see if anybody starts coming through. Yeah, that works quite well for many folks. Tell you what, Joel, why don't we take a quick break? We'll hear from DX Engineering, and we'll be back.
Okay.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime, and we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel. The reason I was torturing listeners at the beginning with my awful rendition of Summertime was because sporadic E tends to take place during the summer, correct? And also for a brief time during December and January. Is that right?
That's typically the case, although I don't think you can rule it out any other time. I mean, it is sporadic. So once you think you know what it's going to do, it'll do something different.
But it seems like most people, in fact, I'll even see on some of the reflectors, they'll post, oh, it's May. You have to start watching 6 meters because you never know. It's sporadic season.
Yeah. Well, and the 10-meter contest is on in December, and that's usually the first weekend in December or something. I always try to do the 10-meter contest because it's so interesting to see what happens when people are actually on the band. And I'd always say, gee, if the weekend before, the weekend after, all these people were on there, you'd work them too, but nobody's there, so you don't know.
That's right.
But it works. Seems to work very well. It almost always has good propagation somewhere. Sometimes it's very dramatic, but it usually has at least some sporadic E openings.
Is it true, Joel, that we really don't know what causes sporadic E, why the clouds form to begin with?
Well, I have to say I don't know, but I'm sure there may be somebody that spent a lot more time studying this that may have some ideas. But they are some kind of ionized gas in the lower ionosphere, and they do what they do, and they always have, I guess, even before people put radio signals into them. They had clouds up there. But, you know, it's important that we know that we talk about the interest in sporadic E and the magic band. Well, the magic band, another magic thing about it is there are other propagation modes that we shouldn't forget, because a lot of people have a lot of fun with them, too. And some of them are always available.
Yes.
I'm thinking particularly scatter, meteor scatter communication. Mm-hmm. The military used to use that. Before there were satellites, that was the medium haul communication mechanism, and they'd set up a big station with a very directive antenna, a lot of power, and they'd blast into the region that has meteor trails and so forth, and they would get good communication for 80-100 miles or so, and it was very reliable. And that still can be done today by hams. The problem is, and we're not talking about our 10-watt station and attic antenna here. We're talking about Sirius antennas, which some people have, and Sirius power. But sometimes the meteor trails are there sufficiently so that even lower power stations with medium-sized antennas can get through. But if you want to make it work all the time, you need to really blast it. So that's one kind of thing. Another thing that happens is tropospheric ducting, which I think that's mostly a summer phenomenon. It tends to be along the coast, but it may happen other places. But what you see is all of a sudden, back in the days when we watched TV with antennas, all of a sudden, instead of watching Channel 2 from New York, you'd see Channel 2 from Memphis or something, or South Georgia, coming through, completely overtaking the local TV station. So that was very common, and it also works on the higher bands. So what's magic about 6 meters is that all of a sudden signals will appear when there were none before, just like pulling rabbits out of a hat. So it is kind of magic, and I think the key is, to my way of thinking, you don't want to spend hours and hours listening to atmospheric noise with your headphones looking for stations. You want to find a way to actually do it in a more systematic way that doesn't require your full attention, like having something that trips open on beacons or FM stations or something like that, because you can go absolutely bonkers waiting for signals to show up. Because not only do you have to know that the band is suddenly open, but you have to tune to where the station is. And there are calling frequencies that can increase the probability of that, but that doesn't always work either. Anyway, there are lots of different propagation modes. And, you know, one day, if we all live long enough, we'll get another set of conditions that allow the F-layer to support 6 meters. And that will really be fun. And then we'll see people working into Europe and around the world on 6 meters. I didn't mention moon bounce, which people use 6 meters for. Again, that takes pretty high power and big antennas, unless the other station has a great big antenna and a lot of power, and especially if you use some of the software, now the Joe Taylor software that's designed to make up for signal-to-noise ratio, you can do better with fairly reasonable-sized stations.
That's true. And what about the guys that work auroral propagation? That's an odd thing. I've heard that a few times in my ham career. Very strange stuff.
I think it depends on where you are. I think mostly occurs near the poles, and therefore you have to be close, fairly north or fairly south. But, you know, much of the United States can use auroral propagation as well. So when that shows up, and sometimes you can see it, you go out at night and look up there, and if you see all kinds of lights up there, you go and turn the radio on and see what happens. Oh, and the other thing about auroral is, if you're thinking about auroral propagation as a possibility, generally point your antennas north. Don't point it towards Ohio. Point it towards the North Pole.
Point it toward the aurora, yes.
Yes, exactly, because that's where the propagation happens. So that's another mode, too.
Now, going back to sporadic E, there was a question I wanted to ask. Can sporadic E get up to 2 meters? Can it ever get that high?
I'd hate to say never, but I don't think it usually gets up that high, that's for sure.
No, that'd be unusual, yes.
I think so.
But
some of the other modes, I mean, I don't know about aurora, but certainly ducting and meteor scatter, I think, can support 2 meters, and certainly moon bounce, for
absolutely.
Sure. In fact, it's easier at 2 meters.
I wonder if you have a particularly intense sporadic E opening, if that can be present on 2 meters. I seem to vaguely recall hearing that was the case, but I'm not sure.
It certainly seems possible, and I would think more likely 70 megahertz if you're in Europe.
Band,
that's definitely within the range, I would say.
Well, do you want to take a question, Joel?
I could do
is
that.
Is it a good time for that? Okay. Adrian, VE7NZ, is asking, when I narrow my IF bandwidth on CW, I get an improvement in signal-to-noise. Okay. For example, a weak signal with 500 hertz bandwidth is in the noise, but with 50 hertz bandwidth, it is quite clear. While operating digital mode using SSB in the transceiver, does the same principle apply? For example, if I narrow the audio bandwidth from 3,000 hertz to 300 hertz, if so, would it be possible to achieve exceptional signal-to-noise when using narrowband mode such as JT9, if I could narrow the passband to perhaps 14 hertz?
Well, that's an interesting question, and the fundamental answer is the principles of physics have to apply, and the narrower bandwidth will reduce the noise, no question about it. But the question is, you can only take advantage of that one place at a time. So in CW and sideband, reducing the bandwidth gives an immediate, you can hear the difference in the noise level as you reduce the bandwidth, although single sideband has less room to work. So for example, going from 3,000 hertz on single sideband to 2,000 hertz can improve the signal-to-noise ratio on sideband, but you're only reducing it by 1.8 dB because that's how much reduction there is between the two. Changing the CW bandwidth, and using your example, from 500 to 50 hertz reduces the noise power by a factor of 10. Increasing the signal-to-noise ratio by the same amount. And even more dramatically, if your transceiver tends to default to the single sideband filter on CW, unless you do something different, if you tune a station in with the filter at 2,500 hertz and go all the way down to 50 hertz, you'll actually make a 17 dB improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. That's almost 3 S-units. So it's quite dramatic. Now, this can happen anywhere in the receiver system where you reduce the bandwidth. There are some advantages to doing it in the front of the receiver because that eliminates other signals that will cause intermod problems and other things. But with digital modes, I believe, and I'm not an expert on the processing that happens with them, but I believe the effective bandwidth is actually established in the digital signal processing software itself. So that advantage is taken care of for you by the software that Joe Taylor designed, and he's taking that into account, I'm sure. I can't imagine he wouldn't. I mean, you could design a software that didn't do that, but I don't know why you would. And then you would find it would not be anywhere near as effective as these modes are. So I think that the selectivity that's happening is actually happening in the PC that's doing the processing. It's not dependent upon the receiver IF bandwidth. But there is a caveat to that. You still have the issue of not overloading things in the detection process. So if there's a nearby signal in the bandwidth, that could do a number of things to degrade the performance. For example, the obvious one is it would, if you didn't reduce your selectivity, it could cause the AGC to reduce the sensitivity so you couldn't hear the station. So the bandwidth narrowing will improve the signal-to-noise ratio, but it can only happen in one place. I mean, you could do it in multiple places, but it's not going to get any better than the tightest one, which will probably be in the signal processing software. In some digital modes, having a wide bandwidth allows you to look at multiple signals on the screen and pick the one you want and so forth. And if you can actually watch what happens as you reduce the bandwidth. You zero in on one particular signal. All of a sudden, that's the only one you see on your screen. But you'll notice it doesn't get particularly better or doesn't appear to have a higher signal-to-noise ratio. I'm thinking PSK31 as an example. You tend to want to have the wide bandwidth there, and then you can see the signals that are in the operating range. So the same principles apply, but they apply in a different place for most digital modes, I think, is the answer.
Excellent. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.